It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The Los Angeles-class fast-attack submarine USS Pittsburgh returned to its home port at Naval Submarine Base in Groton, Connecticut recently, marking the successful completion of its final deployment. What makes this occasion extra special is that the USS Pittsburgh is under the command of a Pittsburgher, Commander Jason Deichler from Scott Township. Commander, welcome to the Confluence.
Thanks, Kevin, and thanks for having me today.
So you pull into your home port. Were there mixed emotions? Happy to be back in the States, happy to be back home, but sad that it was the end of the last mission, the last deployment?
Absolutely, Kevin. I describe it as bittersweet, to tell you the truth. It was amazing seeing our families and the support given by them on the pier. It's always the best feeling to return home from a job well done, to see them, but to know that my boat, my submarine named after the Pittsburgh, was on its final deployment was definitely a bittersweet experience.
When did you get command of the USS Pittsburgh?
I took command in January of 2018, so I've been on board for about 18 months as the commanding officer.
Did you know at that time that this would be its final deployment?
I did not know at that time. And I found out once we had really started into our preparation for this deployment.
All right, so you didn't know it was the last deployment, but how did you feel when they said, Commander, here's your new assignment, it's the USS Pittsburgh?
I felt very proud to be the last commanding officer of the USS Pittsburgh. I was given my orders, and I executed those, and we're still executing them. So although it was disappointing not to be able to operate the submarine at sea for another deployment, the pride I have knowing that my name will be the final one as commanding officer just outweighed a lot of that.
I understand you've served on other subs, is that correct?
I have. This is my fourth submarine. Previously, I served on the USS West Virginia out of Kings Bay, the USS Springfield out of Groton, and the USS Asheville out of San Diego.
Is there always a close relationship between the crew, its skipper, and the vessel, and the city for which the boat is named?
I'll tell you, it varies, and I've seen it vary throughout my career. We try. We try to maintain that close relationship with the cities, and it just depends on how much the command is willing to maintain that relationship and how much the city is willing to maintain that relationship. But on all submarines I have served on, and both the command and the city have made those efforts, I would just tell you that the Pittsburgh has been very special in the efforts that they make to support our ship.
Also, can you give us an example of that support?
Yeah, absolutely. I'll tell you, I talk to three organizations from Pittsburgh on a regular basis. The Pittsburgh Navy League really does a lot of great things for our boat. That's led by Bob McPherson. They do a lot of donations. They do a lot of PR for us, and they really take care of the sailors. The Submarine Veterans Association of Pittsburgh, led by Huey Dietrich. Those are our old retired submariners, salt of the earth. Those guys, they take care of us again with donations, just making sure my crew is okay and maintaining that legacy. And then the final group is something I had never seen before on previous submarines. It was called the Pittsburgh Relief Crew, and that's led by John Caspero. This crew came about when the submarine was first commissioned. Their prime goal is to truly take care of the crew with things such as scholarships. So they've raised funds for a scholarship for the children and dependents of my crew. They've done things such as make sure that we're welcomed home correctly, take care of our single sailors when they come home with bags of toiletries, because, you know, when we come home from deployment, you're not always ready to reacclimate. But that relief crew, I'll tell you, they took care of that, and they've been just truly amazing. And I truly love talking to all of the people that are associated with it. It's just great Pittsburgh people.
Do you think part of that relationship is also the longstanding tradition of Western Pennsylvania in terms of military service and the number of men and women who want and who have served?
So I'm not sure I can give any factual data for that, but I will tell you the feeling that I get when I went back was that there is that strong pull for the technology that we create in Pittsburgh, how we use that, the education, the willingness to serve, and that blue collar attitude of we're going to get it done and we're going to do it with hard work. I see that throughout the military and throughout our city.
You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin, joined from afar by Commander Jason Deichler, a Pittsburgh native commanding the USS Pittsburgh, which is now in Groton, Connecticut. Commander, your last deployment, you steamed, I understand, approximately 39,000 nautical miles. That's like almost twice around the world at the equator. What was the purpose of the mission?
So we're actually a multi-mission platform, just like every other fast attack submarine in the Navy. It truly enables us to get five of the six maritime strategy core capabilities for the Navy: sea control, power projection, forward presence, maritime security, and deterrence. And we were able to achieve five of those while on deployment.
And this deployment lasted how long? I gave mileage, but how long were you at sea? And I know you made stopped at different ports internationally, but how long were you at sea for this deployment?
So we were at sea for this deployment a little bit over 8 months. So we started in June. And as you mentioned, we did some port calls and we did our job at sea. So we spent, of those 8 months, I spent about 200 to 215 of those underway.
Has the role of the Los Angeles class submarine changed in the few decades that it's actually been used by the Navy?
I would say that as the mission and as the demands in our world landscape changes, the missions may change a little bit, slightly, but we're really designed to excel in the areas of anti-submarine warfare, anti-ship warfare, strike warfare, special operations, intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance, irregular warfare, and mine warfare. And that hasn't changed since the advent of the submarine. It just depends on what the policy of the day is and where you need me to go.
So how do you address those steps? You were talking about the different aspects of your mission. How do you accomplish those over the course of, you know, 8 months?
So it's a lead-up period. It takes my crew about 12 months to get trained and ready to go and get out to sea and accomplish these missions. And it's really just like any sports team. I equate it a lot to the Steelers, Pirates, Penguins. We get out there, we have a game plan, we have a mission, and we practice over and over again by getting the ship to sea. We have highly advanced trainers that we can use, computer simulators. And then once we're out there doing our mission, we continue to train every day. And that's really the concept that I took from organizations in Pittsburgh, such as the Steelers, who have sustained excellence. I mean, it is truly, when I watch them and people laugh at me, but it is that sustained excellence year after year, day after day, that I'm striving for on board the submarine.
Oh, all right. So you're talking to your crew. Do you bring up Steelers analogies when you talk to your crew?
I will tell you, there's more Steeler analogies. My war cry, if you call it, on the submarine is "Here we go." So every time I end something, that's what our crew shouts out back at me. I personally have a gift from a friend of a great quote by Jack Lambert that he had engraved in a piece of granite for me that said, "This game is meant to be played by the men that hit the hardest. If you're not in it for that, then you better get out." So I carry all these things with me, and the crew does know that.
It's nice to know that your home is never far from you.
Yeah, that's for sure.
The Los Angeles class submarine, it's being phased out, replaced by, I believe, the Virginia class. Is this strictly updates, modernization, or are there new functions of the Virginia class can do that maybe the USS Pittsburgh and its sister vessels cannot?
So the Los Angeles class submarine, as you mentioned, has been around since the 70s. We built 62 of them. We currently have 35 in active service. The Virginia class is meant as the replacement fast attack. It does bring additional capabilities, but the Los Angeles class submarine, such as the Pittsburgh, even having been commissioned in 1985, still is one of the most formidable submarines out there. But you are correct. It is an upgrade in a different design for the new Virginia class submarine.
You were recently back here in your hometown visiting, I believe, your old high school and, among other things, USS Requin, World War II era sub that people know is stationed outside the Carnegie Science Center. What was that experience like being back home for a little while?
The experience to come back to Pittsburgh is one that I always treasure. My family still lives there. My sister is the vice principal at South Fayette Middle School. My mother-in-law and my sister-in-laws all live there as well. So that truly is the most special thing about going back to Pittsburgh. And experience in the Requiem, so I've had that experience when I was younger. When it first came to Pittsburgh, I was at Carnegie Mellon. So coming back as an actual submariner and commander, that was really the first time I'd gone there in uniform. And I got to experience a lot of great feelings going through that with the World War II veterans, the sub vets, and just talking to them about their stories on that submarine, submariner to submariner. It changed the whole landscape and really made a difference and an impact on me. And as I told those sub vets as we were touring the submarine, I look around and I see them and I know what my future is going to be like. It's a future of brotherhood amongst men that have served. And I'm excited for that future. I'm excited to share times with them as I get older.
Your sub was the fourth vessel named for Pittsburgh. Are there any hopes that somewhere down the line there might be a fifth?
There are absolutely hopes. I hope every day for it. I think that's a very common question I was asked. I will be an advocate for that. There is a committee that selects those names, and I truly believe that the city of Pittsburgh needs to continue to be represented on a global front with our proud warship. So I will be an advocate.
So the USS Pittsburgh is being retired, decommissioned, but what about its skipper, Commander Jason Deichler? You're too young for retirement, so what's next for you?
I serve at the pleasure of the President of the United States and those appointed above me. So I will be given orders to go on to another job, whether it be a staff, whether it be on shore, whether it be another submarine. I'm not quite sure yet. As I mentioned before, I'm focused on the task at hand, making sure the Pittsburgh gets itself to the right place at the right time so that we can decommission her. And from there, I will move on in the Navy and hopefully continue to serve our country.
Commander Jason Deichler is from Pittsburgh, specifically from Scott Township, and he is the final commander of the USS Pittsburgh, which is being decommissioned after nearly 35 years of service. Commander, thanks so much for joining us, and thanks so much for your service.
Thank you, Kevin, and I hope everyone in Pittsburgh gets a chance to listen to this, and I want to thank them all for coming out and supporting us when we were in Pittsburgh. You have a great day.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski. Still ahead on The Confluence. The deadline to file taxes is today, and while some are hoping for a big return, others prefer to have less held throughout the year. We'll take a look at how paying taxes can be a pretty emotional experience. Then, a survey found that 42% of Americans don't think Social Security will have enough resources to provide benefits once they reach retirement age. Is there any truth to that? What conversations would you like to hear on The Confluence? Email us at confluence@wesa.fm or leave us a voicemail at 412-315-6778. Get more from this and past episodes of The Confluence at wesa.fm/confluence.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, Bo, a Portuguese water dog, arrives at the White House to be with his new presidential family, the Obamas, in 2009. Bo is the son of Watson, also a Portuguese water dog, who lives in Ambridge, Pennsylvania, about 20 miles northwest of Pittsburgh. Bo was bred near Erie with Penny, who lives in Texas. He was born that October along with 9 other siblings. Bo was almost chosen by then-Senator Ted Kennedy, but was instead picked to become the first dog for the Obamas. His breed was important because he's hypoallergenic, a perfect fit for Malia Obama. He'd be joined by Sonny the dog 4 years later. That's today's Pittsburgh Almanac.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Ruthie Walker wants every kid who walks through her door to have a quality education, something she tries to ensure in her role as a student services assistant and activities coordinator at the Pittsburgh Student Achievement Center. 90.5 WESA's Brian Cook has more.
Ruthie Walker walks the halls of the Student Achievement Center in Homewood, greeting students, making sure each has their eye on the ball. The ultimate goal, graduation.
I grew up in Homewood. You know, I'm one of them people that got to give back. And so I'm really, really passionate about making sure they understand that this ain't the last stop.
The Student Achievement Center is an alternative school in the Pittsburgh Public School District, set up for middle and high school students, grades 6 through 12, to make up credits if they've fallen behind.
It's like a second chance. But when they come here, I let them know that we don't care what happened in the past, because you're starting off clean right here. So from here forward, Let's get those grades up.
Walker has worked in education for over 25 years and says it's important to extend a hand of compassion to students in ways that are needed for academic growth.
I think it's really important for them to understand that we're here for them and that we love them. I got so many students here that call me mom. And that's an honor for me, because my thing is, if you're calling me mom, I'm doing something right.
All right, son. You leaving now? All right, have a good day.
I'm calling your mom because, you know, moms care about you. Moms make sure you good.
That's Joshua Dixon, a high school junior who says Walker's nurturing demeanor isn't one to take lightly, and her method of getting through to students is strategic.
She'll really go out for you. Anything you want, she'll get it for you. But it comes with a price. Like, you gotta be doing good. You gotta be on top of your game. You gotta be on your P's and Q's. You can't just be slouching and think like, oh, I'm about to just be taking her for advantage because she does good for me. Like, nah, that's not how Ms. Walker works.
All right, guys, let's go.
It seemed like a lot of kids are always crowded around her, wanting to ask her questions when she's walking in the hallway.
Math teacher Sandra Ballard taught.
She exposed students to, Black history. That was never enforced before, okay, until she got here. It actually motivated other teachers to do the same. It motivated me.
And she says she's noticed an increase in both student class participation and social interaction.
I really appreciate her being here because I've seen the students grow. They're more responsible. We have more students making honor roll. We have a lot of students on the student council.
Walker says throughout her years working in the school system, she's proud to see students achieve greatness. And part of showing appreciation, she says, is being present for the pinnacle of what should be every student's ultimate goal.
Every senior that's in here that invites me to their graduation, I go to every single graduation. If that means I sit through 3 or 4 graduations in a day, I'm going to be there. Because I am here to make sure you're successful. And their success helps me to be successful. That gives me energy.
I'm Brian Cook, 90.5 WESA News.
Who's making a difference in your neighborhood? Share your suggestion for our series WESA Celebrates 90 Neighborhoods, 90 Good Stories at WESA.FM/90. Made possible with support from UPMC, life-changing medicine.
You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Hurt in an accident? That's the question personal injury lawyer Edgar Snyder's been asking for years on billboards, on television, and on the radio. With his ubiquitous presence, Snyder's arguably the region's most famous attorney. But for our built-in PGH series, 90.5 WESA's Unley Herring reports, he's more of a businessman than a legal practitioner.
Snyder says he's a brand in Western Pennsylvania, and he says Edgar Snyder and Associates built that brand by spending more over the last 37 years than any other law firm on TV ads, such as this one from the 1980s.
If you get hurt in a car accident and an insurance company is giving you a hard time, bring your troubles to me.
A car crashes from the ceiling, crushing a law office desk in front of Snyder.
I'm attorney Edgar Snyder, and I'll go after the insurance company to get the money for your medical bills, lost paychecks, even for your pain and suffering.
The attorney signs off with his signature line.
And remember, there's no fee unless we get money for you.
Thank you so much for calling Edgar Snyder & Associates. How may I assist you?
At his firm's office on the 10th floor of the U.S. Steel Tower, Snyder remembers the U.S. Supreme Court struck down a ban on legal advertising in 1977.
And that really and truly changed the entire way the business of practicing law has been in this country.
The legal community had long viewed advertising as unseemly, but the justices said it would increase access to legal services. Still, Snyder says he got heat when he started to run ads.
We were considered pariah in the business world. People used to say to me, what's a good trial lawyer like you doing, stooping down to do things that don't seem very professional?
Snyder had been working as a solo practitioner in Duquesne, where he'd meet with steelworkers at night after their shifts had ended. His first ad was a small square in the newspaper. It offered to fight charges under a newly tightened DUI law. And Snyder says almost instantly he got call after call from new clients.
It was an amazing discovery. We had the largest practice at the end of 1 year from what we call a tombstone ad.
Soon, Snyder and Associates made the expensive leap to television. In-house marketing staff created the commercials and initially bought time in lower-cost areas.
Business took off to such an extent that my biggest fear was not getting business. It was how would I handle it?
Snyder eventually gave up litigating cases so that he could keep the business running. Today, there are 140 employees with offices in Pittsburgh, Altoona, Erie, and Johnstown. Snyder estimates the firm's 36 attorneys take about 1,000 new cases every year.
I learned how to run a business by making mistakes every day of the week.
And he made tactical decisions along the way. For example, hiring claims adjusters away from the insurance companies his clients sued. It was a quality control measure.
And they knew what to do better than I did. They taught me the claims business.
Snyder says he also knows when not to pursue growth. He says the firm turns away several thousand cases a year, referring them instead to outside attorneys.
Because I found you can't do everything.
Snyder, who's now semi-retired, says what's important is sustaining the business while also allowing for growth.
I think I created a legacy of this type of work with a model and good people that now run this place that are taking it to better heights, bigger heights than I even did, and I see it lasting.
Snyder says he likes to think his brand will live on and continue to help personal injury victims find the legal support they might not otherwise consider. Anlie Herring, 90.5 WESA News.
And I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The deadline to file taxes is today. Many people hope for a big tax return, but not everyone thinks that way.
I'd probably rather get less held throughout the year. I guess I'm just one of the lucky people. The refund doesn't really matter that much to me.
No, I'd rather get a big tax return at the end. I just put it in my savings account.
When you are paying taxes, you're actually giving the government a no-interest loan. So instead of making interest on your own money, you're giving free money to the government. So you should always plan out to not have a refund at the end. You should spend your money appropriately throughout the year.
That was Andrew Tarek of Dormont, Chad Miller of Forest Hills, and Leslie Klopperich of Collier Township. As part of our new occasional series, A Moment of Science, 90.5 WESA's Kathleen Davis talks with University of Pittsburgh business professor Nicole Coleman. She says paying taxes and getting a big tax return can be a pretty emotional experience.
Well, I think that the process of paying taxes and everything is very cut and dry and straightforward, right? But when it comes to money, it's ours, right? We worked hard for it and we want to be able to control our own money. And I think that when we talk about paying taxes, people generally feel pretty negative emotions towards it, right? This is money that you worked for and slaved over, and the government is taking a chunk of it. And so I think generally speaking, taxes are fairly negative emotional experience for most people.
So what is happening in the brain when we receive a windfall, like a big tax return?
Sure. So in the brain, we have this reward center. It's an area in our brain that responds anytime we experience something pleasurable. And that could be, you know, eating some chocolate. That could be watching your child take their first steps, enjoying the sun on your face on a rare spring day in Pittsburgh. Any of those things can light up your reward center in your brain, which causes your brain to release dopamine, which makes you feel good, relax. It actually lowers your blood pressure. Are all good things. And receiving a windfall, be it a nice hefty tax return or, you know, winning a lottery ticket, any of those kinds of situations also feel like rewards and light up that pleasure center and make us feel good.
And I'm guessing we don't get that same feeling when we put a little bit into savings each month.
Absolutely not. And that's really the crux of it when it comes to the tax refund and these windfalls is, you know, putting money away in savings, it feels like sort of the thing that you should be doing. It's a chore. It's not rewarding in the same way of feeling like some money has fallen into your lap, even though it was your money originally to begin with.
What's your recommendation? Should people save a little bit from each paycheck and have a lower withholding, or withhold more each month to get a bigger tax return.
This is one of those kinds of situations where you need to look at yourself and you need to ask yourself how you behave. Because the fact of the matter is the right thing, the economically prudent thing to do is to withhold less and put money in a savings account, because even though interest rates are low, there is interest that you will earn and you don't get that with withholding. But the fact of the matter is most of us don't do that, even though we know that we should be saving. And it's very hard to save. It's difficult because it's not rewarding, and it feels like you are deliberately reducing your take-home pay. And so, you know, you need to sort of look at yourself in the mirror and say, you know, as much as I might intend on saving, will I actually do it? And if the answer is no, that's okay. There's no judgment. That's fine. Then it makes sense to actually maintain the higher withholding and have that sort of forced savings that occurs with the refund that you get later in the year. The problem, of course, is that we don't treat the refund like savings. So when we get this windfall, we tend to spend more of it than we would if we were looking at the same balance in a savings account.
Nicole, thanks for speaking with me today.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
That was 90.5 WESA's Kathleen Davis speaking with University of Pittsburgh business professor Nicole Coleman. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. In 2019, an estimated 64 million Americans will receive close to $1 trillion in Social Security benefits. But what about future generations who might be questioning the sustainability, even the solvency of the system? Legislation has been introduced into Congress to try to address some of those questions. Jamie Meredith is Senior Vice President of Heffron Tillotson Wealth Management. Jamie, welcome to The Confluence.
Oh, it's great to be here.
Okay, according to a new survey from Pew Research Center, 42% of Americans don't think Social Security will have enough money to provide benefits by the time they retire. What's your take on that? Does that seem right?
Well, it's not only the respondents of the poll, but the trustees themselves are projecting that Social Security, it's not going to run dry. That's the big fear, that will it go away? It's not going to run dry, but they project by 2034... incomes will not be large enough to pay 100% of the benefits. The estimates right now that you might see 20% cuts, 25% cuts on the current trajectory, but there should be enough income from current workers to again cover about 3/4 of estimated benefits.
Okay, so that's another 15 years or so. So they're is time, or is it time shrinking to address that?
Well, certainly time is shrinking as fewer and fewer folks are in the workforce. If you look back to 1960, there were almost 6-to-1 workers for beneficiaries. As time went on, that slowly shrank to 4-to-3. Now we're at about 2 and change of actual workers per Social Security beneficiary, and it's supposed to stabilize around 2 going forward. That has a lot to do with birth rates and the baby boomer generation and that big wave leaving the workforce. And as folks continue to leave the workforce, well, certainly there are fewer and fewer taxes going into the pool. So it's going to get more and more expensive the longer we wait to fix this kind of imbalance.
You mentioned, according to the Social Security Administration, in about 15 years or so, taxes will only be able to cover about 75% of the scheduled benefits. What role will reserves, what sort of reserves does the Social Security Administration have?
Well, right now, the reserves are about $2.8 trillion. So that's a lot of money. That's with a T. It's a big, big pile of money. But it's projected that this year and next year, we're going to start dipping into that principle, as folks like to call it. So over the next 15 years, we're going to take larger and larger chunks. Not only are we going to spend the incomes, not only are we going to spend the inflows, we're going to have to start dipping into that principle. And the projections are, again, it's only going to last about 15 years before we fully deplete that $2.8 trillion.
So is the Social Security Administration, are they crying wolf at all, or is it numbers don't lie?
The numbers don't lie. Really, the projections have been fairly solid for the kind of the run-out day for about 20 years now. It fluctuates. Sometimes it's high 20, 30s. it hit as high as 2040 at certain times, but it continues to fluctuate around these times. And it's fairly easy to project. You look at birth rates, you look at work, you look at income. So it can do a fairly accurate job of projecting it if nothing happens. The big question is, what do we do? How do we fix it? It's about a $200 billion shortfall per year. So the Social Security Administration projects that if we were to increase the FICA taxes, and that's what it's called, right, where we collect the taxes, by about 2.8% in total, that would plug the hole. So we're not talking about an insurmountable obstacle. We're not talking about a radical change in taxation. We don't need to have taxes go up by 30, 40 percentage points. If you were to split that with your employer, you're talking about 1.5% for both you and your employer. And I think for most folks, you know, that's not a huge mountain to climb over. Certainly none of us want our taxes to go up.
Right.
But if addressed soon, it's a fairly easy problem to fix.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. Our guest is Jamie Meredith, Senior Vice President of Heffern Tillotson Wealth Management. We're talking about solvency of Social Security. You mentioned the possibility of tax hikes. Well, Congress has been talking about for years about shoring up Social Security. The Social Security Act 2100 has been introduced into both the House and Senate. What do you feel are the key points of that legislation?
Well, certainly they're looking to expand benefits. They're looking to increase revenue. And, you know, the issue with a lot of these attempts is there's not a lot of political will right now with both the politicians and the voters. We've got some big issues and, you know, a problem 15 years from now for a lot of folks in Washington and for folks around the United States is not a problem today. We've got bigger fish to fry. So, you know, we've seen a lot of these revisions and we don't get too excited about it until it gets a little closer to reality.
Expand benefits. Is that the more difficult one to swallow in the sense, hold it, there might not be enough money or there isn't going to be enough money in the current rate of taxation?
Well, certainly that's the big question. How are we going to pay for it? We can't pay for existing benefits. You look at the projections and again, it's going to be bankrupt. How do we expand benefits? And, you know, one of the things, if you look at Social Security and you pop the hood and you dig into how it gets the benefits are calculated, it's a rather convoluted calculation that doesn't have a lot to do with reality. You look at a lot of pensions, they're pretty easy. You work so many years, you get so many percentages of your income into this. Social Security is a rather bizarre system with these Ben points and PIA fractions and things like that. It's an odd bird that is really hard to kind of fit.
Even if this legislation is not passable in its current form, is it important for Congress to at least start focusing on this?
Oh, it absolutely is important. Again, to fix this hole today, again, you're looking at about 1 to 1.5% if you wanted to just do the tax increase on both the employer and the employee, which, again, is not an insurmountable sum. I think there's a lot of things they need to modernize, and Congress needs to look at it now. The more they kick this can down the road, the more and more expensive it's going to be, and most likely it's going to, again, fall on the back of us taxpayers to do that. So it's going to be a cost the longer that we delay this.
Yeah. Social Security Administration says benefits represent about 33% of the income of the elderly. If that's the case, then they would be relying more and more on pensions and other income. But how concerning is it for the elderly who don't have a pension or don't have much of a pension?
Oh, it's very concerning. You look at your typical family heading into retirement, then there's dramatic statistics from the Fed to private industry that 60% of retirees have less than $1,000 saved. So most folks haven't accumulated that nest egg. They have not accumulated. They have not stored away those nuts for winter, and winter is coming. And for a lot of folks, Social Security is really all they have. And the system was never really designed to be the primary source of income for anyone. It was there to kind of round the rough edges of life off. And that was back in a time where pensions were a lot more prevalent. Today, it's very rare to see pensions, and folks' kind of psyches and long-term thinking haven't quite caught up to the fact that, well, if you don't save for yourself, you're not going to have anything other than Social Security because the time of pensions are over. And a lot of folks are realizing that very late in the game. So again, Social Security for many, many, many folks out there plays a big part. Most likely the outcome is going to be for younger folks, maybe we'll push back the retirement age, the full retirement age. Currently at 67, but longevities have stretched almost a decade. So I think you could make a fairly good argument that for young folks today, maybe 67 is a little bit early. Maybe it should be 68, 69, somewhere around there. But I think folks, if you do the math, folks born in 1967, their full retirement age is 2034 is that kind of D-Day. So I think folks older than born earlier than 1967 probably won't see many changes. Folks born after 1967, probably future Social Security is going to look different than your projections today.
All right. So those younger generations that you were just alluding to, how can they make sure that they've got enough money? You said Social Security was never meant to be the prime source of income after retirement. So what do you think for the younger generations?
You must save, 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 save. And it's a challenge for a lot of folks. People were not really wired to think about tomorrow. We're wired to think about today. And it's a challenge for a lot of folks to think about what life is going to look like 20, 30, 40 years down the road. We work with a lot of retirees, and I ask them, wouldn't you like to go back to your 20-year-old self? And what would you say to that person? Would you kick that person in the butt, grab them by the collar, and say, if you only would have done this, 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 and this, life would be so much better today? So it's a challenge to get young folks to think about that. The magic number used to be around 10% of your expected retirement salary. So if you're a young person today, you get your first job, it's great if you can save 10% of your current salary, but ideally you save 10% of kind of what your future salary is. And that means sacrifice. That means when all of your other friends are buying cars, well, you continue to drive the old jalopy that you got from your cousin. And it might not be as cool, but it saves you a lot of money. You've got to make those sacrifices. Our society has really confused wealth and consumption. And we look at someone driving a BMW, and my kids say that, and they say, wow, they're wealthy. Well, having done this for a long, long time, I look at that and say, well, that's almost, you know, the opposite of wealth. You're spending a lot of that money. And so consumption is not wealth. Living below your means is wealth. And we all need to do that. And a big part of that is save, 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 save till it hurts, and then really save a little bit more.
Final question regarding legislation in Congress. You mentioned it's going to cost more the longer you wait. When do they really have to get something done, would you say, so it doesn't hurt too much?
Well, I think, again, they need to do it sooner rather than later. 2018 and 2019 is the year that we start dipping into that principle. It's going to get more and more expensive. Again, right now, the estimates, we have a shortfall of about $200 billion, which is about 1% of our current GDP. Which is a fairly large number. And that's not once, that's every year, every year, every year. So the longer we wait, the more we start chipping away at that 2.8 trillion, that 1% is gonna grow to 1.1, 1.2, 1.3. And after a while, it's gonna be 2 to 3 to 4% of GDP. And then you look at all the other things we have to tackle. And it's only gonna get worse, maybe at a time where maybe the economy is peaking, maybe in a few years we're heading into a recession. And then you can see where all of these lines are converging, and it's going to be a challenge to deal with this 2 or 3, 4, 5 years down the road.
Jamie Meredith is Senior Vice President of Heffron Tillotson Wealth Management. Jamie, thanks so much for coming in.
It is great to be here.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, a conversation with State Attorney General Josh Shapiro about the status of his lawsuit against UPMC and an investigation into makers of legal painkillers. Plus, a new groundbreaking exhibition on the Vietnam War and how that war impacted American society. If you missed anything from today's program or you'd like to catch up on past shows, please visit wesa.fm/confluence or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance by Mick Stanelli, Julia Zenkovich, and Alex Lenigan. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.